From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program are Jessica Von Zastro and Ashley Obelgen, assistant producers in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. Our topic on this edition of the program: are more female voices needed in U.S. foreign and national security policy? And if so, why? Our guest, Rosa Brooks, co-founder of the Leadership Council for Women in National Security, or LCWNS. This is an innovative new organization that aims to increase the number of women, especially women of color, in top positions in the national security and foreign policy domains. Rosa Brooks is a professor of law at Georgetown University. She's also a scholar at West Point's Modern War Institute. From 2009 to 2011, Rosa Brooks served as counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. From 2012 to 2017, she was a columnist and contributing editor at Foreign Policy magazine. One of her most recent articles is entitled "Tear Down the Foreign Policy Glass Ceiling." She is co-founder of the popular foreign policy podcast Deep State Radio. Her most recent book is "How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything." Rosa Brooks, along with five other high-powered women who have served in senior foreign and national security policy positions, who co-founded LCWNS, have come together to provide the public leadership and specific benchmarks to improve gender diversity and fight unconscious bias in the field of national security, regardless of political party. They believe that women's inclusion, especially at senior levels, is critical to the development of smart policy options, from the Me Too movement to the record number of female members in the 116th Congress. Issues of women's role and advancement are now, finally, on the front page. Therefore, given this unique cultural moment and the talent and expertise resident within the Leadership Council for Women in National Security, the co-founders believe that they have a unique opportunity to transform outcomes for women and for U.S. national security. Currently at the Pentagon, less than 16% of all senior positions are held by women, and for women of color, those disparities are even larger. We'll talk with Rosa Brooks about LCWNS recommendations as to how the United States can specifically and concretely include more women in top positions in national security. And Rosa Brooks joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Carol. It's terrific to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues, Jessica Von Zastro and Ashley Obelgen. Well, Rosa, first of all, let's talk about your organization, LCWNS. When and why did you come to co-found the organization called the Leadership Council for Women in National Security?
You know, this organization, like all great organizations, started over drinks. A group of women who had worked together at the Department of Defense and had then left, and some of us had gone to academia, some of us had gone to think tanks or different jobs. We would get together every now and then for drinks, just for fun. And the conversation almost always turned towards shared frustrations about barriers to advancement that we had all faced as women working in a field that is still very, very male-dominated. All the conferences that had panels with all men on them and not a woman to be seen, the meetings where the women would say something and everyone would ignore it, and then a junior man would say the same thing, and the male chair would say, "Oh, what a great idea." And after a while, these sort of gripe sessions to be, we also started turning it into kind of a support network. When one of us was applying for a job or was saying, "Look, I've been invited to give a talk. How much money should I ask for? Can I ask for a fee?" That the group started playing a role of, "Yes, you know, I happen to know here's how much the man got last year at this conference. And so you should ask for the, you know," things like that. And at a certain point, somebody said, "We should formalize this because it feels like there is an important role for supportive networks of women to help each other, to raise awareness of the structural barriers that women face, to raise awareness of the benefits that gender diversity can bring to decision making." So over a period of a couple of years, we expanded the group beyond this initial group of people who had worked together had some brainstorming sessions with others who are focusing in their own work on gender and foreign policy, gender and national security. And finally, just a couple of weeks ago, June 25th, was our official launch. And we went public. We've got a fantastic steering committee and advisory committee of some of the leading women in the field, ranging from Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, to Admiral Michelle Howard, who was the highest-ranking African-American woman in the U.S. military ever. And it's really exciting. I think it feels like this is a moment when it is a lot of things have come together and it's finally possible to make some real change.
Well, it sounds like Elsie Wynns is advocating a sort of affirmative action for women in national security. That is, all things being equal in terms of qualifications. If, for example, you have a roster of men and women applying for a particular post, what you're saying is give extra consideration to female candidates.
It's not even necessarily saying give extra consideration to female candidates, because here's a myth that we really want to dispel. The myth is that, oh, well, of course there are more men than women at the Pentagon or at the State Department or in the U.S. intelligence community. More men than women just go into these fields, so there aren't as many qualified women, and that's why you see this imbalance at the senior level. 30 years ago, that would have been true. It's not true today. Today, women are entering the field in equal numbers. Today, we have a really deep bench of hundreds of women who have worked at very senior levels across the U.S. national security and foreign policy community. The problem comes in a couple of different ways. One is that much as we all want to be fair, when we're making hiring decisions or when we're trying to decide who should be on this panel, people tend to hire and contact the people they already know. And when the hiring committee is made up of men, that's going to mostly be men. It's not so much to say all things being equal, let's hire the woman. It's saying, how do we get rid of the small, often subconscious things that lead hiring committees, particularly when they're male-dominated, to dismiss the women's achievements as being lesser when they're not necessarily. And it comes out in subtle ways, and I'll give you a couple of examples. Women who have unbelievable experience and incredible achievements under their belts being told, well, we gave the job to a man who had less experience because we didn't think you had command presence or gravitas or something. And I don't think that the people who make those decisions are being sexist on purpose, but I do think that what happens is a lot of us still in 2019, when you think leader, we have this image in our heads, and that image in the United States of America tends to look like a white male middle-aged guy. It doesn't tend to look like a woman. It doesn't tend to look like a person of color. And that can be changed, but people need to make a really conscious effort to do that. We do know now in 2019, we have a really clear sense of what the best practices are to make sure that it's not, you know, again, it's not giving the woman a boost, all things being equal, but to make sure that you are not overlooking the equally and often more experienced and talented woman as a result of those kinds of unconscious biases.
Well, thank you very much for that clarification, and we'll continue on that. But first, let me turn to my colleague Jessica Von Zastrow for a question.
So one of the initiatives that Elsie Wynns has proposed is this 50-50 gender representation by 2020. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about some of the specific initiatives that Elsie Wynns is proposing to try to get to this 50-50% representation.
Yeah. No, and this was our first big initiative that coincided with our launch, is we asked all of the candidates running for president of the United States. As listeners know, we have an election coming up in 2020, and we called on every single candidate in both parties and said, we would like you to pledge that if you are elected president, that you will seek gender parity in your senior national security and foreign policy appointments. And that's not a quota. What that means is that you will employ those best practices, and we will help you do that to say, how do we make sure that the people on our transition teams, that the people on our presidential personnel staff who make those crucial hiring decisions at the senior level, how do we make sure that they know what you need to do if you do care about diversity? And we want to make sure that when you are hiring, that you consider all the evidence, and there's an enormous amount of evidence out there that diverse teams make better decisions. They are more creative. They are more innovative. They're less likely to fall prey to sort of dangerous groupthink or overconfidence. And that diversity is not, it's an independent good. You know, that there's a fairness issue here, to be sure. 50% of the population is female. Women should have an equal shot at those leadership positions. But even beyond fairness, this just has to do with how do you have teams that make good decisions, that make responsible decisions, that make wise decisions, particularly in this very dangerous world that we live in. So we asked all the presidential candidates to pledge that they would try to do that. And 15 of them did that. All of the leading candidates on the Democratic side, every single one of them, from Joe Biden to Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, et cetera, agreed to take that pledge. We reached out to the Republican side as well. We haven't heard back. But we're really excited about this because, you know, it's not hard. If you want to find talented women at any level in this field, from the most junior to the most senior, there are lists all over the place. The challenge is combating those kinds of structural and unconscious biases I talked about a little while ago. And to have 15 people who are the political leaders in the United States publicly say, yes, I agree with that. And if I'm elected, I'm going to do that. I'm going to make that happen. I think that's incredibly powerful.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Rosa Brooks, co-founder of the Leadership Council for Women in National Security, LCWNS. She's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and a law professor at Georgetown University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Jessica Von Zastro and Ashley Obuljan, assistant producers in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Hideyuki Kanamatsu from Japan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And before the break, Jessica, you wanted to ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, so I wanted to briefly follow up on the 15 Democratic presidential candidates who have so far taken this pledge. Although LCWNS is a nonpartisan organization, only the Democratic candidates so far have taken up this fight for gender representation in national security appointments. Notably, the current president, Donald Trump, has not joined this cause. Do you fear the repercussions that women in national security might face if President Donald Trump were elected for another 4-year term?
So two things. One, we are a nonpartisan organization, and we have on our steering committee and our advisory committee some fantastic women who have served in senior positions in Republican presidential administrations, as well as Democratic administrations. And we feel very strongly that this is not and should not be a partisan political issue. This is both about basic justice and, as I said a moment ago, it's about making sure that we have the best, most talented, most thoughtful, most creative decision-making teams. We need that. The world needs us to have that. The world needs that. So we absolutely see this as not an issue of Democratic Party versus Republican Party. That said, yeah, we are certainly disappointed that we haven't seen a similar commitment on the other side of the aisle. Even the shift from the Obama administration to the Trump administration saw some real setbacks in terms of the numbers of senior women. They dropped across the board at all of the national security and foreign policy agencies. And so despite some very visible women in a handful of senior positions, overall, the last couple of years have not been great ones for women in leadership. And this president does have quite a number of concerns that have been raised about his own personal attitudes towards women. So while I don't think it's a partisan issue at all, I do absolutely wish that the current president, and certainly if he is reelected, I absolutely wish that he would take a quite different approach to these issues than he's currently taking.
Well, we do want to follow up on that topic, Trump's cabinet and foreign policy, the substance and message. And for that, let me now turn to my colleague, Ashley Olbulgin, for another question.
So on the subject of the Trump administration, at the recent Group of 20 summit in Japan, President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed the concept of fake news and also joked about getting rid of journalists. Considering that 25 journalists have been killed in Russia since Putin took office in the year 2000, is it appropriate for Trump to have this sort of dialogue with the Russian president? And what is your take on this as someone who has spent a lot of time as a journalist herself?
Yeah, my take on that is it's not a very funny joke. The last few years across the world have been particularly deadly years for journalists. We've seen, the Committee to Protect Journalists has documented a significant increase in attacks on journalists around the world and deaths of journalists. And Russia is a particularly egregious example, both of censorship at the most benign level, and it's not very benign, and of persecution, active persecution of journalists up to and including killing of journalists who have been critical of the Russian government. It's very upsetting to see an American president treat that critical human rights issue, critical free speech issue, critical rule of law issue as if it's just funny, like, ha, ha, ha. We all have to deal with pesky journalists. I think the real tragedy when an American president jokes about things like that is that the message it sends not only to Vladimir Putin, but to others around the globe is, go ahead, persecute journalists, even kill them. I don't care. The U.S. doesn't care. And that's a pretty devastating message. I think that to the extent that the United States has been able to play a role as a global leader, it has more to do with our, what people sometimes call soft power than it has to do with our military power, that we are effective as a global leader when people admire us and what we stand for. And when we stop standing up for human rights and our values, I think not only is it devastating for the human rights defenders and brave journalists trying to work in very difficult conditions, but it also diminishes our own power around the world.
Well, that leads me to my next question, Rosa Brooks. Joe Biden, former vice president and now candidate for 2020, and one of those who signed your pledge to include more gender diversity, particularly women in national security, outlined this week what he calls a forward-looking foreign policy to counter the so-called America First strategy of the Trump administration. What is your overall critique of the Trump foreign policy, both the message and the messengers? And I say messengers because, as you said previously, we don't see very many women in senior foreign policy or national security positions.
Well, I don't think I'm making any news when I say that a major criticism of President Trump's approach to foreign policy has been that it's very transactional. It's very much a kind of, what have you done for me lately, like yesterday? What did you do for me this morning? And President Trump has been inclined to be very dismissive of longstanding U.S. relationships with close allies. He has been very negative about NATO. He's been very negative about longstanding alliances with Japan, with the South Koreans, you name it. And, just as America is absolutely most effective on the global stage when people think we stand for something other than, hey, we've got a big military, when people think we stand for positive and appealing values, similarly, we're most effective when we have friends. No matter how big your military is, if you're trying to go it alone, it's really hard to be effective. And I think that the most devastating thing about the approach to foreign policy of this administration is it has very much broadcast the message to democratic states that do respect human rights, we don't care that you have been working with us for decades on these things, while meanwhile broadcasting to states and to leaders that are autocratic and repressive, from Vladimir Putin to Erdogan in Turkey to Viktor Orban in Hungary to Bolsonaro in Brazil. Hey, you're the people I like. I like the way you get things done. Duterte in the Philippines. I like the way you get rid of those pesky journalists. I like the way and that is, it really is just devastating. I think in terms of the messengers, one of the problems that the U.S. is having right now is that and again, I don't even think this is a partisan issue. I think that the approach President Trump is taking is one that would have been stunning and shocking to any of the last few Republican presidents of the United States as well. It's really out there in a way that has nothing to do with political party. He's very much in a class of his own. And it's also been a uniquely dysfunctional administration across the United States government. In every agency, key positions are vacant. We don't currently have a Senate-confirmed Secretary of Defense. We haven't had one for quite a while now. For instance, at the State Department, many of the highest level positions are vacant. They're filled by acting officials. And it's not even clear, even if you have a better message, it's hard to be effective when you just don't have people in key roles in your government, or the people who are there are only there on an interim basis and don't have the confidence of the president. So just across the board, I think it has been a terrible mess.
Let me turn to Jessica for a follow-up.
So one of the other issues that we're looking at in this time leading up to the 2020 election is looking at the way that foreign actors have the ability to influence our elections. From a national security standpoint, what do you think that the Trump administration should be doing right now to prevent interference in our elections in the future?
That's a great question. And I think the first and most important step is acknowledging it as a problem. Obviously, Russia is the particular foreign actor who played what was clearly a significant role in attempting to influence the 2016 election. And the conclusions both of the United States intelligence community and I think of the great work that's been done by many of our media outlets is that not only did they try, but they succeeded, that there is a fairly substantial possibility. It's impossible to fully quantify that Donald Trump would not be in the White House had it not been for Russian interference. And here again, you know, going back to what I said a moment ago about I don't even think this is about party, but I think that if this were almost any other president, he would be saying, I recognize that the legitimacy of my presidency is cast into doubt by the well-documented reality of Russian efforts to manipulate the election. We are going to, as a matter of urgent priority, I'm going to ask Congress to appropriate the funds to shore up the security of our electoral systems. I'm going to be working with social media companies such as Facebook and Google to do a better job than they're currently doing, to recognize when you have external actors who are sowing misinformation using social media tools. It is quite difficult to do. I absolutely don't want to suggest that, oh, if only the White House wanted to do this, it would be easy. It wouldn't be. But I do think the first step is you have to acknowledge that you have a problem. This White House is not even able to take that crucial first step, which would start those conversations about, okay, then, what do we need to do to protect the integrity of the ballot itself? Okay, then, what do we need to do to keep foreign money from influencing political groups in the United States? What do we need to do to try to make sure that misinformation, let's be honest, lies, are being spread by social media companies that have the power to crack down more effectively on those?
Well, indeed, and in that regard, if 2016 is any indication of Vladimir Putin's disdain for female candidates, and I'm referring, of course, to Hillary Clinton, perhaps fear, he will have no compunction about trying the same thing again to thwart candidates who he thinks would formulate a tougher policy toward Russia.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, what's more disconcerting or as disconcerting as the fact that Mr. Trump himself hasn't quite acknowledged that Russia, in fact, did interfere in the 2016 election and did so on his behalf, we have a Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who is resisting taking up legislation that would safeguard our elections.
Yeah. No, this is a frightening moment to be an American. I think it's actually a frightening moment to be a citizen of the world. There are so many threats that we all face, ranging from climate change to the continuing threat posed by terror groups, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear competition, you name it. And to have the country that is still the one superpower, despite all of our dysfunctions, the United States remains the one outsized global power. To have that power be in a state of total disarray, open to foreign influence, unable to make the most basic political decisions that would safeguard the integrity of our own democracy, makes it particularly scary at a moment when we really need the U.S. alongside partners to be stepping up and saying, okay, everybody, we've got some serious issues. Let's work together to solve them. We really have the U.S. essentially absent.
Well, let me ask you this, Rosa Brooks. L.C. Wins advocates for a diverse group of people, particularly women, in the national security field, based on the fact that this diversity can produce more creative, effective solutions to complex problems and issues. How might decisions, for example, regarding U.S.-Iran tensions, the U.S.-North Korea nuclear standoff, the U.S.-China trade dispute, climate change, and immigration reform, which is really the nexus between domestic and international policy, differ if more women were part of the decision-making process?
So I don't want to suggest that there's some simplistic thing going on here. And I always kind of find myself reacting negatively when people say things like, well, women are just more nurturing and more peaceful than men. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. That being said, I think it's whether or not you believe that there are inherent biological differences that will always exist, or whether you accept that or reject that, and that we'll have sort of systematic patterns in decision-making that are different. I do think it's fair to say that right now at this moment in the world, the experience of the average woman differs in some significant ways than the experience of the average man. And when women are in leadership positions, they bring those experiences to the table. A lot of the research on the effect of having women in leadership positions actually comes to us from the business world, where there have been many, many studies that suggest, for instance, that women investors have higher rates of return over time than male investment managers, in part because they are less likely to make really risky decisions. That corporations that have better gender diversity on their boards and in their senior management across the board tend to perform better. They make more money and they're healthier on other measures of organizational health. And I think that if we extrapolate from that kind of evidence in other fields to what we might see if we had greater gender diversity in foreign policy, I think that there is a lot out there that suggests that women are less likely to be dangerously overconfident, less likely to take dangerous risks, more likely to be open to considering alternative ways to proceed. And there's just overwhelming evidence that when you include women at higher rates in peace negotiations, in economic development, you name it, you just get better outcomes. You get more enduring peace agreements. You get greater levels of economic prosperity. So it seems to me that the evidence that we have so far strongly suggests that while it's impossible to say exactly, well, you know, if there were more women in Trump's cabinet, would the U.S. have pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal or not? Who knows, right? That I think at the level of any really specific thing, there's no way to make a prediction. But I think I do feel pretty confident in saying that across the board, we might see less recklessness, a greater willingness to consider non-military solutions, and a greater willingness to just be creative and think outside the box.
Rosa Brooks, give our listeners the website for the Leadership Council for Women in National Security.
Sure. The website is LCWINS. It's LCWINS.org, LCWINS.org. And we would love for people to check out our website. And, you know, one other thing I should say, here in the U.S., for reasons that have to do with our own complicated constitutional and legal history, it's currently not lawful to have quotas for the number of women. You can't say, well, we're just going to require that there be half women in parliament or half women in this or that. But in many other countries that have different legal traditions, they do say that. And we've seen tremendous advances for women in Europe, in various African countries. These kinds of efforts are not unique to the United States. And in fact, although I wish I could say the U.S. is in the lead, in many ways, we are way behind what other countries are doing when it comes to gender diversity. So I'm hoping not only that some of your listeners who are listening in other places will check out our website, but I'm also hoping that we will be able to learn and benefit from the experiences of women in other countries.
Rosa Brooks is a co-founder of the Leadership Council for Women in National Security, LCWINS. She's also a former senior national security official, author, and law professor at Georgetown University. Rosa, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about LC Wins.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis and Jessica Von Zastro for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. Joining me on the program was Jessica Von Zastro and Ashley Obuljan, assistant producers in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.